This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For 100 years, medical practitioners have been trying to figure out post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. A recent article published by The Conversation suggests we need to expand thinking about PTSD and learn why different patients are helped by different approaches. Joining me are two of the authors of the piece, Marissa Brandt, who is an assistant professor of practice, and Robin Bloom, an associate professor of philosophy, both at Michigan State University. So let's go back 100 years. As soldiers came home from World War I, some of them had what came to be known as shell shock. How did doctors at the time diagnose that condition?
Doctors at that time diagnosed this condition largely through physical symptoms and behavior changes, ranging from a lot of melancholy to not being able to actually use your limbs to total catatonia. People had a wide range of symptoms that made it very difficult for them to go back to their lives and go back to work.
In the piece, you described that at first thought people had concussions or something like that, some kind of traumatic brain injury maybe, but then they found out eventually that that didn't necessarily have to be the case. So what did they decide shell shock was caused by?
There were a lot of different theories about what it was caused by, but during this time, the early 20th century was also the rise of psychoanalysis and early psychology in America. And so it was a time when people started to think that maybe not only physical, you know, violence could create changes in people, but also psychological experiences, the meaning of experiences. And different psychiatrists working in different places had different theories, which led them to quite different treatments at that time.
Right. Some of them chalked it up to a personal failure, a weakness. And the treatments you mentioned were really bizarre. Could you tell me some of the brutal treatments that were described in a paper titled Hysterical Disorders of Warfare, which came out in 1918?
What happened is they would think that there was something sort of blocking the soldier from sort of returning to himself. And so I don't think they put it quite like this, but because the disorder was caused by some sort of shock or trauma, they almost seemed to think that having some sort of therapeutic shock or trauma might actually restore their function. So they would do things that now look absolutely horrifying to us, like using electric shocks or burning people with cigarettes to try to get them to overcome their problems.
Or react in any way in some cases.
In some cases, yeah.
Let's fast forward to the Vietnam War era. Medical thought has evolved through World War II and the Korean War. Vietnam veterans really started to take control of this issue themselves. They demanded treatment for PTSD. How did that affect how medical profession and others saw the disorder?
Well, just to step back a second, the Vietnam veteran activists of the 1970s, working with psychiatrists like Hai Shatan and Robert J. Lifton, were actually the people who got PTSD to be seen as a diagnosis in the first place. They had already been coming together, people like Vietnam Veterans Against the War, to create support groups where they saw their activism as part of their therapeutic treatment, but part of what they really wanted by getting the American Psychiatric Association and the military to recognize this diagnosis, which they successfully did in 1980, was to be able to get disability compensation, to be able to get access to treatment in the VA. But the VA at that time, you know, that was a new diagnosis. It was something that up till that point, you know, they'd been treating as depression, anxiety, psychosis in some cases, and treating based on those models. And so they really had to start improvising and working to come up with new treatments in 1980 because they were faced with a new diagnosis that suddenly explained the conditions of many of their patients.
Now, your article suggests that we cannot understand PTSD or its treatment if we keep thinking of it in strictly medical terms. Can you explain why you believe that?
I think strictly medical terms has to sort of come apart into two different concepts. There's the medical clinical sense, which is concerned with patients' experiences and how physicians and other healthcare professionals can help them. And then the biological sense, which is the idea that there's some sort of underlying people often use the term malfunction, something physiological that's not working well. And I think that the underlying physiology, even though it can be very important in helping us to understand what to do at a clinical level, in part because we don't have that knowledge now, is only of limited usefulness. But also, if we just focus on the biology, we're missing a lot of what the experiences mean to the people who are actually suffering from PTSD symptoms. And I think that without developing a sense of where they're coming from, there's really only a limited amount that can be done to help them.
I was surprised to read in the article that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs estimates about 13.8% of returning veterans who served in Iraq or Afghanistan are dealing with PTSD. What kind of treatments are being offered today?
So in 2007, 2008, the VA and the DOD did a kind of massive overhaul where they researched all the kind of empirically supported treatments for PTSD. And what came out of that was recommendations for two psychotherapies, one called cognitive processing therapy, where a person writes about their trauma and the meaning of their trauma and tries to kind of work to different stages of processing that meaning. And then another one called prolonged exposure therapy, wherein a person actually tells the story of their trauma over and over again until they become desensitized or habituated to the feelings that are associated with telling that story. But not every VA is going to have the same number of therapists who are trained in those therapies, which are often very labor intensive. PE, for example, takes 90-minute sessions that you could have once a week or more, which are very difficult to schedule. So a lot of people end up getting pharmaceuticals. They end up on SSRIs or other drugs that help them to manage their symptoms like any other anxiety or disorder or depression.
You pointed out that the patient has a role in determining treatment, and that's helpful. Why is that?
One of the most important factors in somebody getting better is what's called the therapeutic alliance, the agreement between the therapist and the patient that they are in this together, that they have a common goal, which is helping this person to overcome their symptoms, overcome their problem for a particular reason. So if the patient doesn't believe in the therapy, right, or they don't want to do the therapy, there's only so much that a therapist can do to really convince them otherwise. So the patient's buy-in is really, really important to having a successful therapeutic relationship.
How well do we understand PTSD today?
I'm not sure. In one sense, I think we don't understand it any better than they did during the First World War. In another sense, I think we do know a lot more. So we have a better understanding, for example, of what kinds of treatments would be effective. We're definitely not burning people with cigarettes anymore. And we have a much better sense of what's going on in the brain when people process traumatic events or when they're haunted by traumatic events. But in terms of having a really good sort of conceptual understanding of what PTSD is, why some people get it and others don't, how to best help people who have different kinds of symptoms, because there's a lot of variability in the symptoms of PTSD, we're still really trying to understand the big picture.
I want to ask you about the conclusion of your article, because it kind of says, hey, we've got more areas to explore here. What's the bottom line that you want people to take away from the article?
I think that one of the things that we're doing well now that we weren't always doing in the past is to recognize how debilitating traumatic experiences can be and the long-lasting effects that they can have. So that's one thing that's, I think, really important, that we're paying attention and at least trying to do something. That said, I think that there's still a lot of work to be done.
I think it's important for us to not get overly limited in our thinking about how to help people. There's a lot of new apps that are supposed to help people with PTSD. And, you know, I've studied a lot of virtual reality therapy. And one of the things I hope people take away is that we should continue to expand those interventions in a variety of ways and also not be limited by thinking of any one treatment as being that which helps people, but really thinking about trauma as something that people deal with in a community, in a social setting, in our culture. And we all kind of have to come together and think about what it is we want to do for traumatized groups of people like veterans and what we want to do to support them and help them make meaning out of their experience. And while these interventions are great and diverse, I think it's on all of us to try to make a better world for people who experience these kinds of traumas.
That's Marissa Brandt, and we'll hear from Robin Bloom. They, along with Mary Catherine McDonald, are the authors of an article titled From Shell Shock to PTSD, A Century of Invisible War Trauma. You can find it at theconversation.com. Thanks to both of you for talking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.